When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
What's going on, everyone? Welcome back. It's Jay Scott. It is The Hook Rocks, the ultimate rock community podcast. Appreciate you tuning in once again. Thank you very much. We always appreciate when you do. Don't forget to write us a review when you're done listening. We always appreciate the feedback. We are part of the Pantheon Podcast Network, a great network at pantheonpodcast.com. A whole bunch of music-related podcasts, including the official Metallica podcast, The Metallica Report. Don't forget to follow them on all social media apps at Pantheon Pods, and don't forget to search The Hook Rocks on Twitter, Instagram, Facebook, and Threads at The Hook Rocks. And don't forget to set your app to automatic download so you get the latest episode right to your phone, as well as all the others we've done previously. We've had a tremendous year so far. We just had Dee Snider on, which was a great interview. We celebrated the 40th anniversary of Stay Hungry, and we did the same with Out of the Cellar with Stephen Piercy. We also had Vinny Appice, George Lynch, Jeff Pilson, Joe Satriani, and a whole bunch of new bands too as well. Scott Holiday of Rival Sons, Tuck Smith, Primal Moon, a great Chicago-based blues band, and many more. So please check out all of those. And we've got an incredible guest today that I am really excited about. This is a more music from when I was growing up. The artist that we are going to introduce here shortly had a huge impact on music back when I was growing up in the 80s and 90s. One of the front runners, one of the main influence of female rock bands today, and that is Lita Ford. I'd like to welcome her into the show. Thank you very much.
Jay! That was a huge introduction. Thank you so much.
Well, it's the truth, right? I mean, that's really the essence of your legacy is, you know, when you think back of that time back in the day, you know, it was you with the hard rock. I mean, obviously there was Joan Jett. She was more rock. And then there was Ann Wilson, it was mainstream rock, and a lot of others. But you were the, you know, the big deal in women in hard rock and heavy metal.
I was the badass. Is that what you're trying to say?
Absolutely. Absolutely the badass.
Still to this day. I mean, you know, we're still growing up, right?
We never do. We never do grow up, right?
We never do. I know it. It's scary.
It totally is. But we're going to get into all that. First, I like to always ask the same first question we always have when we have a first-time guest, and that is the essence of the show. Just like every rock song has a hook that pulls you in, every rock fan has a moment, whether it's a song, an album, a band, or performance that hooked them on rock and roll. What was it for you?
Oh, you know, I can't remember exactly what song, but I had a whole list of favorite songs that were just sort of very riffy. You know, Deep Purple, of course, you know, Blackmore. And I liked stuff like Johnny Winter, Grand Funk, you know, they had some badass riffs, and Black Sabbath, you know, just the real riffy stuff, you know. So if it's not riffy, I don't think it was on my playlist when I was just first starting out.
Where did it go from there? I mean, where did your growth in guitar playing come from? I mean, you mentioned some great bands and some great guitar players, but what was the evolution at that time in your life of exploring music?
You know, I don't really even know. It was almost like, you know, here you go. This is who you are, and this is who you're going to be. And you will be Lita Ford, and you will play guitar. And I thought, oh, okay, well, this is who I am and this is what I do. And it really didn't ever really cross my mind. I mean, it still kind of doesn't. But I have to say that my cousin took me to my first rock concert at 13 years old. And I had already been playing guitar for 2 years. But at 13 years old, my first rock concert was Black Sabbath at the Long Beach Arena in California. And it completely changed me. It was like somebody had a light bulb went off when I saw that concert. You know, it was kind of strange, but I thought, well, that's it. That's what I want to do with my life. There it is. Watching, you know, the guys in Sabbath. And of course, you know, my favorite was the guitar player, always the guitar players.
That's such that's such an important moment. I equate how new rock is struggling with the lack of younger audience. And people always say, how do I get my kid into rock and roll? Take him to a rock concert. I mean, I did with my son when he was 5, and it completely changed his life. I mean, a kid is never going to experience, especially today when they got their nose buried in the phone and everything's technology. They don't even leave the house half the time. When you take them to a concert, it's like nothing they'll ever experience. The synergy with the crowd, the performance, people singing along. It is incredible for totally like sensory overload. It's unbelievable.
Yeah. You know, I don't know. Concerts have changed over the years, you know, so it's, if you find a good concert in your area that comes up and you have the opportunity to go, I would suggest, you know, don't miss it, because just like everything, things are just being neutralized. And back then, you know, it was 2000. I was 13. What year would that be? 77, 80, 1980. Is that right? Am I doing my math right? It was 1980 in Long Beach. But I mean, just a lot of things are being neutralized now. So I remember Motley Crue, when Motley Crue first came out, Nicky used to bring in 2 PA systems and he would just melt everybody in the place. And I love that. You know, Sabbath were loud as hell. And volume is part of the rock and roll, you know, feel and vibe and stick it in your face. I mean, that's what Marshalls are for. You know, they're to project the sound and, you know, I don't know. I mean, you know, a lot of the venues now are, they keep a volume control on the band and make you turn it down and you know, I fight it every show. I just want more and louder. And it's amazing that my hearing still works. I must be standing in the right place at the right time or something. I don't wear earplugs or anything like that. So, you know, I just have to feed off of everything in the room and hear what I'm hearing and feel it. And Sabbath were one of those for me when I was 13, walking in and seeing all the hair and guitars blazing and people, and everybody was smoking at that time, mainly pot. And it was illegal at that time. So I was like, wow, this is so badass. I want to do this. You know, that was it. My whole life flashed in front of me, literally.
That's pretty cool. That's an amazing story, or amazing, you know, what you say. I mean, I went to a Priest concert 2 years ago, I think it was, and I walked out of there. I couldn't hear for a week following that show.
Oh, you were standing at the wrong place.
I think every seat in that place was the wrong place then. That was just loud.
Yeah. Yeah, I don't know. You know, I don't even know what to say. You know, maybe take it out with their front of house sound man or something, you know, add some more lows. But I mean, Rob Halford's voice is off the charts. It's just piercing. And that's, you know, that's a cool thing. It's just, you know, they want to shatter your brains. It's kind of what it's all about.
It is what rock and roll is all about, right? I mean, that was, but that's what you look forward to. Like you just said, you know, the loudness of something, the volume. It was always a conversation between people of like, who's louder? Who was louder? Maiden? Was it Crew? Was it Kiss? Was it all these bands? And if you knew a band was going to be loud, it attracted you more to the show because you wanted to be blown away.
Yeah, it definitely helps. You know, we did a show recently at a casino in Mount Pleasant, Michigan. It was really a great show. And it was so loud. And sometimes they cap the volume at a certain decibel because there's people staying in the hotel or there's a nearby hotel or whatever. And we travel, of course, with our own front of house sound man. And he's just a badass and he will push it to the limits. And so during sound check on that show, the PA system they supplied for us was just monstrous. And so we pushed it and our front of house sound man came out and he said, "Oh, it's bloody loud." And I said, "Good, exactly. That's what we want. Let's do this." And, you know, I felt a little sorry for the people in the front because my marshals are pointing directly at them. But, you know, after a couple of songs, it kind of kicks in and everybody just goes, "Yeah, I love this. This is just rocking." You know what I mean?
When you think back to that time and being a female artist in hard rock and heavy metal, what was it like navigating through a world that is predominantly men and men control the industry and men control the clubs? I know you came from the Runaways, so you had a name and a reputation, but that must be, I mean, obviously it's a lot different now, but what was that like for you?
It was a lot of games, you know, and men, you know, men are just men and they're not anything indestructible. It doesn't mean anything, you know, and a lot of the situations were they couldn't put two and two together. And it wasn't just men. It was a lot of people, but then on the other hand, you know, they couldn't put together the fact that, oh, she's a female and she's playing guitar. Huh? How does that work? Well, to me, it never really registered. I just thought, well, I just want to play guitar. And it never dawned on me really that, you know, you're a female. Oh, well, nobody told me, you know, I mean, I knew because, you know, but I never really put two and two together and thought, well, I can't do this because I'm a female. And it never really, you know, made sense to me. And guys, a lot of the best musicians, you know, a lot of them were men. And I have to say that a lot of them helped me to achieve certain rock celebrity status, and just hanging out with the best of the best musicians, you know, they didn't look at it like, oh, she's a girl. No, she can't do this. They didn't look at it like that. They were different, you know, like Dee Snider, for instance. You said you just had him on your show. I mean, Dee was such a huge support for Lita, and we opened for Twisted Sister many times, and Dee would always go out and rile the audience and get them pumped for our show, you know, coming on. If we were doing a festival or, you know, if we performed before them, he would always come out and rile them. Even in the early 80s, you know, he was just all about it. And people like Ritchie Blackmore, you know, he never judged me because I was a female. And a lot of these great musicians are really non-judgmental people. It's all about the performance. And yeah. So
and if you
that's
play,
what
right?
You gotta separate, you know, the losers from the leaders, so to speak.
Well, that was such a time of great musicianship. I mean, that's one of the things that you hear a lot about when you talk about bands from the 80s. You know, a lot of them are dismissed, but they can outplay the majority of the musicians that came after them. You know, whether it's the guitar, whether it's singing, the drumming. I mean, you put the guitar players from that period up against the guitar players of the grunge era and beyond. And there's some good players, don't get me wrong, in that era, but it's the knowledge of the instrument was way more expansive back in the 80s than it was after that.
Well, I think that's comparing apples and oranges, kind of, you know, and I think a lot of things, I mean, technology changed along with the music scene in the 90s, and things became different. And we were trying new things and trying to dial down certain things and increase other things. And so everything changed at that time. So what happened in 1977 or, you know, 1978 at a Black Sabbath concert wasn't necessarily what was happening in 1995. It just was all different. The guitars were different. The amplifiers were different. The clothes, the hair, the songs. It was just a whole different animal. And it was something for the 80s artists to figure out. And there was some really special bands that came out of the 90s. You know, I'm personally not so much a Kurt Cobain fan, but I did love the Stone Temple Pilots and Alice in Chains. Oh, I mean, Jerry Cantrell on that wah-wah is sick. It's so good. And there's some good stuff in there. Guns N' Roses. I think Guns N' Roses were 90s, right?
And I think the follow-up, Use Your Illusion, was in the 90s.
So, I mean, you know, a lot of big things came out of there. And they kept it going, and they kept those riffs alive, and they kept them rocking and being badass. I'm a huge Jerry Cantrell fan. As a matter of fact, I use his wah-wahs live. You know, switch from a crybaby, which was the Jimi Hendrix wah-wah, switch to Jerry Cantrell, and they're just sick. They're so good.
What is your approach to guitar? I mean, obviously you talk about the volume and the Marshalls, but when you're playing, when you're looking at the instrument and you're approaching a song, where do you go to first?
It doesn't matter when you're approaching a song. Excuse me. Something can spark an idea and you have to go with that idea. It doesn't matter if it's a riff on guitar or piano, or somebody says something in a conversation and you think, oh, that's a good song title, or that's a really cool riff. And for me, what I have to do is I have to write it down or put it in my cell phone right away, because if you don't, it changes within, you know, 10, 15 minutes. The title will change and you won't have the same feeling about it. And so it doesn't really matter where it comes from. You know what I mean? Just so long as you're in that writing mode and you have to grab it right then and there and bring it to life.
Because you have, you're a dual threat, as they say, you know, singing and guitar playing. Do you approach a song first with the melody, with a riff, or do you think of lyrics first?
Well, it kind of goes both ways, and sometimes different lyrics are sung better. So even though it might look good on paper and you write, you know, you jot something down, it doesn't sing well. So if you try singing something, you know, and you just think, well, no, I'm going to change this word and I'm going to change not necessarily the meaning of the lyrics of the song. And that's, you know, that's kind of another thing too. You know, I have a new record in the can and I'm sitting on it. It's driving me mad trying to get it out. And a lot of that process happened for me during the making of that last record. And my songwriting partner passed away, but it's good to have somebody to bounce your ideas off of, and a songwriting partner, so to speak. It's also good to hear it. So if you record it on your, say, your cell phone, on your voice memo, for instance, something so simple as just listen to what you just did. It's kind of like looking at yourself in the mirror and taking a selfie. You might look good in the mirror, but then you take a selfie and you're thinking, oh, you know, what was I thinking with my hair or my makeup or whatever? It's wrong. So you end up changing little things. It's the same with the songwriting process. If you can hear what you're trying to put down, it helps you to see it better. Does that make any sense?
Absolutely. You know? You know, I mean, you got to have the vision, and that vision encompasses a lot of different things. And sometimes it's sparked by a lyric, a word, a melody in your head. I mean, writing music is very complex on one hand, and it also, you know, it's also not rocket science on the other hand. You know what I mean? Like, I think the two worlds kind of combine in like the seamless structure of creativity.
Well, I think that's why a lot of big bands will redo some cover tunes that they hear, you know, maybe from the past. I think Judas Priest do Green Man Alishi.
Yeah.
Is that right? So yeah. Wasn't that, what's her
Fleetwood
name?
Mac. Stephen Nicks.
Fleetwood Mac.
Yeah.
I mean, and so Priest own that song. I mean, not physically own it, but when they perform it, they make it theirs, because a good song is a good song, and good songs are really hard to come by. You know, you might think you have a great song, but then try and put it down and see what it looks like, see how it feels, and get everybody's opinion. You know, not everybody's opinion matters. If it moves people, that's all you need to know. It either moves you or it doesn't. And they don't need to be technical about it and say, oh, well, you know, I don't like this guitar part. Or it's like, well, wait a minute. What do you know about guitar parts? Do you like the song? Yes or no. Does it move you? Yes or no. You know, it's like getting somebody to do the electricity in your house when all they know how to do is paint. Don't ask them about the electricity. All they need to do is flip the switch and see how good the lights are. You know what I'm saying?
Right, right.
Not everybody's good at everything. You know, we all have our niche. And songwriting may not be it. And this is why sometimes these bigger artists will reach out to a real songwriter. Because, you know, songwriting is a whole different animal.
When you think of the new music that you have, that's in the can, a new album in the can, what do you see, or what do you think the changes are for you in your creative process and your writing than it was back then, back in the 80s, late 70s, early, you know, into the 80s?
Excuse me. Well, I think, you know, I think sometimes you have to live it to feel it and understand it, and then put it in writing. Put it in a song. And some of the best songs are so simple.
Hello, Pantheon podcast listeners. Christian Swain here to tell you more about my experience with Raycon earbuds. Our family now has three pairs of Raycon earbuds around the house. And my wife just grabbed a pair of the Headphone Pros to replace some headphones from a company that was double the price. And yes, she loves them. Now, if you haven't pulled the trigger on a pair of Raycons, Or even if you have, but you're in the market for another pair because they're just that good, well, now is the time to check them out. Because they just launched their upgraded model of the best-selling everyday earbuds. With Raycon's upgraded everyday earbuds, now you also get active noise cancellation, ergonomic design, and multi-point connectivity that lets you pair with two devices at once. New quick charge function, 3 customizable sound styles, plus awareness mode. Available in a variety of vibrant new colors to complement any and all skin tones. I even have a pair of earbuds in a cool green color. I have tried just about every earbud known to humankind, and these Raycons are fantastic. Seriously, if you've been wanting to check out Raycons, there truly is no better time. You're going to ask yourself why you didn't check them out sooner, and Raycon offers a 30-day happiness guarantee. So, what are you waiting for? Go to buyraycon.com/pantheon today to get 20% off your Raycon order, plus free shipping. That's right, you'll get 20% off and free shipping at buyraycon.com/pantheon. buyraycon.com/pantheon.
But those people that, you know, that wrote those songs, I mean, like, for instance, I listened to Van Morrison. And just on a light day when I don't feel like listening to anything heavy, I will put on all the old Van Morrison songs. And they're so simple. And they're just, you know, songs about walking by the river or, you know, standing in the rain. And it's like, things just got so complicated. And they don't have to be, you know, it's like watching a movie for the first time when you really, really like that movie. And then they do a version 2 and a version 3 and a version 4. Next thing you know, you're just like, what the hell is this movie even about anymore? I don't even know. It just gets so complicated, you know, but I think just keep it real and keep it simple. And, it doesn't have to be complicated. They don't have to have 18, 16 stacks of vocals and 24 different guitar parts. It's really not what it's about. It doesn't make a good song. A good song is a good song, no matter how you slice it.
I think the simplicity that you speak about is probably the most difficult. I mean, you talk about Van Morrison, but even, you know, the Beatles and AC/DC, people for years would dismiss AC/DC as not being great musicians. Their songs are very too simple. Well, it's like, all right, well, you go write a simple track like that. Everybody will know. Everybody will know the song instantly by the first riff. That's very difficult to write those simple songs too. It's not easy.
No, they stick in your head, but it's, you know, AC/DC are just, they're their own animal, you know, they have a feel to them that really nobody can copy. Nobody can duplicate. They were the, you know, the high vocals with Bon Scott and Angus. Those guitar parts are brutal. It's not Steve Vai wailing away with his, you know, a bunch of guitar riffs and notes, and it's Angus and sometimes those rhythm guitar parts are just as hard to nail as it is a really complicated riff or a complicated guitar part. It's a different animal. And I mean, AC/DC are, look at this, the places they're playing and they're selling out. I mean, it just doesn't get any bigger than that, you know, cause they're simple, but it's the feel and the attitude and the understanding of those songs. People can relate to that shit. They get it. They don't need flashy guitar riffs. You know, Angus works his ass off. So does the rest of the band. And Brian Johnson, holy moly. I mean, those vocals are not easy to sing every night. And you try listening to Angus's guitars. You want to talk loud? It's like, you know, it's brutal.
That's the amazing thing about Eddie Van Halen is he had the complex solos, right? But his rhythm playing had so much feel on it. You know?
Yeah, well, I mean, Eddie's stuff was just a style of his own. And when they came out with Running with the Devil, I think that was their first hit. It was just a three-piece band. It was bass, drums, and guitar. And then David Lee Roth. There was no huge vocals or, you know, it was just the right feel at the right time. And they owned it. They were the backyard party band, similar to ZZ Top when ZZ Top first came out. You know, it was taking something like Boston. Remember, Boston had a lot of beautiful vocal parts and these gorgeous guitar parts. And then Van Halen came out and took all those gorgeous guitar parts and all those gorgeous vocal parts and simplified it and put it balls out in your face, straight up three-piece rock and roll. There was no bullshit. It was all meat and no potatoes with Van Halen. And everybody thought, oh, holy shit, you know, what is this? And it was over the top. And Eddie, there was nobody like him. I mean, he was just a mad scientist and he just did his own thing. You know, it really wasn't complicated what he did. If anything, it was the opposite. You know, he wired all his own guitars and wired his cars. And I mean, everything was wires hanging out everywhere. There was really no flashy paint jobs or anything like that. He didn't get all dressed up. He just played guitar Eddie style. And that was the hammer-ons. And the feel Van Halen had, it was just a big backyard party. It hit home with everybody. Similar to AC/DC.
What do you think of the new wave of rock today? The female bands, the Lizzie Hales, the Evanescence, you know, a band like The Warning, these, you know, the three sisters from Mexico. Just, I think they're just tremendous in what they're doing. But for you to be at the beginning of that hard rock, heavy metal, you know, being a female back then to now, What do you see with these artists, these female artists today?
I don't know. I mean, I really don't have a favorite. I really don't favor one over the other. I mean, there's some vocal performances out there that are just monstrous. You know, of course, Lizzie is, she's just a powerhouse. She's really good at vocals. She could sing anything. She could sing Ann Wilson, and I think she's out now doing some Skid Row.
Yeah.
Am I right with that?
Yeah.
I mean, Sebastian is no slack on vocals. I mean, that shit's hard to sing, you know. And then the Evanescence, you know, I'm not a huge fan of the music, but I can appreciate the singer. But taking something from the studio and a studio recording of something is not the same as performing it live. And some of the bands are great in the studio, and I'm not talking females, I'm just talking musicians and singers in general, are great in the studio, but then you put them in front of a live audience on a live PA system and, you know, in front of a live drum set, and it becomes different, a different animal. When you're in the studio, you got your ears, you can control the volume, you can control the effects, the delay, the reverb, you know, whatever you want on guitar. And if you fuck it up, you can record it multiple times. Oh no, that was terrible. Let me do it again. You know, oh no, let me add something to that because that just didn't work. But when you're live in front of an audience and you have a live rock band behind you, then it becomes, you know, this is your chance. You better get it right. And you better make it count and don't hurt yourself in the meantime doing it. So it helps, you know, it all also helps to have your own sound professionals with you on stage who know what you want, you know. It's been so many shows where you just get three songs into the show and you can't even talk. You know, in the studio, you get to stop, have a cup of tea, take a throat lozenger, do a shot of whiskey, whatever the heck you want. But when you're live, you know, you don't get that chance. So it's two different animals.
Do you think
it's great to see people who can cover them both.
Do you think that there's too much of reliance on technology, especially with live performances? I mean, you think back of the fans years ago who wanted that rawness and authenticity. And I think the majority do, but I think bands today get caught up in trying to mirror exactly what's on an album. And I think the fans play some responsibility in that too, because they, especially the younger generation, they expect to hear exactly what they hear on the album. But when you think of the bands that are still relevant today from the past, you know, namely like Led Zeppelin, right? Led Zeppelin is more popular now than they ever were when they were around, which is great. But their live performances were completely different than their studio albums. And that's part of their legacy as their live performance. And I think people expect, you know, with their arms folded to hear exactly how it is on the album. And if it's not, they get online and they say, oh, they're not as good as on the album. That's not what the live show is meant to be, in my opinion.
No, again, it's two different animals. But, you know, again, also, Jay, you know, tuning is just a strange thing. You know, something so simple as your guitar being in tune. I mean, you know, we didn't stop in tune back in the Runaways days. I remember, the Rolling Stones didn't stop in tune back in the early days. Deep Purple, you know, Richie would stand there on the stage and tune in front of everybody, you know, and it's, I one time, oh, this story. Do you know Alice Cooper's Welcome to My Nightmare?
Correct.
Record?
Yeah.
So those guitar players on that record, Dick Wagner and Steve Hunter, they were my absolute favorite dual guitar players. When they played together, it was just sick. Simple stuff, but not simple. And the way they did it was just so great. And I worshiped them. I thought, these guys are just the best of the best at the time. And so Steve Hunter became a friend of the Runaways. And he came to one of our shows in the Runaways days, and I broke a string and I didn't have any help. And Steve Hunter got up on stage and he said, give me that guitar, Lita. And I think it was my SG. So it didn't have any lockdowns or it didn't have a tremolo unit. And the string was easy to change. So he gets up on stage in front of the audience, grabs my guitar, and gets a string and has the audience count to 30. It was 30 seconds it took him to change that string, boom, boom, tune it up, ready to go for the next song.
Wow.
And I thought, you know, rather than trying to hide something, make it obvious and bring the audience in with you. You know, oh, my wireless is down. I mean, of course, back then, we had cables. We didn't have wireless units. So I'm good either way. But sometimes, you know, you just got to do things in front of people and bring them in into what's happening at that time, at that moment. And they get it. They know. Not everything has to be clean cut and dry and perfect and sterile. If your guitar is out of tune, okay. So let me tune it. You know, if your wireless goes down, it's picking up some radio stations or something, you know, okay, try and fix it. And if you can't, then, you know, bring the audience in and make it fun. I mean, that's what I do, you know.
Yeah, I think that's what, you know, the essence of a live show. I don't want to see perfection. I want to see a performance. I want to see, you know, plugging in and playing, and I want to feel it. I don't want to feel like there's a computer determining the tones and the sounds and all these things. You know, I want that authenticity.
Yeah, I mean, well, a lot of these musicians are pretty damn perfect.
Right.
You know, and that's the trick, is to be great. Well, everyone's got their eyes on you. But I mean, you know, shit happens on stage, and that's just it. What are you going to do?
What can you tell us about the new music?
I have to wait for it to talk about it. It's driving me mad. Oh yeah, driving me mad. Isn't that a Beatles song, right?
I know Drive My Car is. I don't know, Driving Me Mad? I don't know.
I'm drawing a blank. It's on the White Album. It was one of those really long extended. But I mean, you know, the Beatles and the Stones weren't tuned. They just tuned by ear.
Yeah.
I don't know. Sorry. Didn't mean to get off on a tuning rant.
No, no worries. No, that's great. I'm here for it. So when I know you can't really talk about it, but is there a time frame what you're looking at for the new music, or that's still open?
Paperwork.
Okay.
So I don't know. You know, it's the least favorite part of all of it.
Yeah. Yeah.
The paperwork.
What about the tour that's happening now, that's starting here in a couple days?
Well, we've been touring our asses off, and we're performing at the Whiskey on April the 11th. It's a Thursday, but we have a special guest, Gary Hoey, guitar player, is flying in to perform with us. And, you know, the Whiskey is just my home away from home. I grew up on the Sunset Strip pretty much. So it's always awesome to go back there. And we always have such a great time. And it's a great show. It's in your face. You know, it's just see it up close and be there. And then 2 days, I think we have a day off after the Whiskey, and we head down to Palm Springs where we play the Agave Caliente Casino. Agave Caliente. So it's Indian Territory and Palm Springs. I mean, it's not in triple digits yet, so it's going to be about, you know, mid-80s, mid-90s. So it's gorgeous weather. And if anyone's in the area, please come and see us on April the 11th at the Whiskey and April 13th at the Agave Caliente Center Casino in Palm Springs.
You gonna make your way up to Chicago at some point this year?
You know, I hope so. I have to look at my itinerary to answer that question. And we're doing the Dio event. The pancreatic cancer event for Ronnie James Dio. I believe it's in mid-May in California. There's a whole bunch of artists. And we're just going to get up and play one song, maybe two songs. But it's just a ton of artists. And, you know, I'm going for the support. You know, cancer is just, you know, got to do everything you can. So love Ronnie. You know, we loved the Dio family, and we're there to support that. But please come and see us at the Whiskey, and please come and see us in Cathedral City, Palm Springs, on the 13th. My lucky number 13.
Lita, it's been a blast. Thank you very much for doing this. I appreciate it.
Thank you, Jay. Thanks for having me.
Absolutely. Anytime. Everyone, that is Lita Ford, the legend. I am Jay Scott. This is another episode of The Hook Rocks. Take care of each other. Stay safe. And we will talk soon. Thank you.
It's NFL draft season, and that means it's time to start thinking about fantasy football. FantasyPoints.com features industry-leading experts and prognosticators using proprietary hand-charted data to help you score more fantasy points. FantasyPoints.com is the place to go for whatever kind of fantasy football you play. Whether you play fantasy football, daily fantasy sports, or do a little bit of everything, Fantasy Points has the meticulously researched content to guide you to victory. And why wait for the fall? Fantasy Points also covers the new spring football league, the UFL. Join the guru, John Hansen, Scott Barrett, Joe Dolan, and other massive names in the fantasy football universe with an exclusive offer. Use code Pantheon for 15% off any Fantasy Points package, including the all-in package, with access to every article, tool, and data nugget that Fantasy Points has to offer. That's FantasyPoints.com and code Pantheon for 15% off at Fantasy Points. FantasyPoints.com, code Pantheon. Score more Fantasy Points.